This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Hi, I'm Ads.
Hi, I'm Bish.
And I like guys.
And I like girls.
But we hope you love this podcast.
Joy 94.9.
Hump Day Crew Joycast.
Sponsored by MyMac.
The best Apple computer, iPod, and Apple accessory store in Australia.
MyMac.com.au.
From partying with bikini-clad models on South America's most glamorous beaches to visiting Bin Laden's Tora Bora caves with Afghan warlords who talk about opening amusement parks in the area, you can say our next guest has a lot of experience. To talk about his experiences with us today, Michael Molongo, greetings in New York.
Well, thanks for having me. Thanks.
Now, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit, first of all, about the countries you've been visiting in the last few years.
Well, I've been to a lot of countries. I mean, I'm a travel writer. I've been to 80 countries, all seven continents. But I think the ones that you're really interested in are the ones the world is very interested in right now. I've been to Iraq a few times. I've been to Afghanistan a few times. I've been doing a lot of travel in other Middle Eastern regions as well.
Now, when it comes to homosexuality in these countries, you don't really hear much about it. Is there a gay scene in any of these countries?
Well, it's hard to really say a gay scene necessarily, and it depends on the country. You know, it's one of the things that I talk about in my book, Gay Travels in the Muslim World, is the variation among the different countries. If you look at a place like Egypt, there was a gay scene. There still is a gay scene. The gay scene itself is what was attacked during the Cairo 52 in 2001 when they arrested 52 gay Egyptian men. So there was a scene, and there was a very visible scene, and that's what was attacked. You have countries like Afghanistan, which, for want of a better word, are a little more primitive or a little more traditional than what we have in the West. So you don't find a gay scene, but you do find that it's rather common for men to have sex with men, but they would never take the label gay. It's a very different way of, you actually have to throw away your perspective of what it means to be gay when you go to some of these places. And then some countries, you know, like Iraq, had a very limited gay scene, a very under-the-radar gay scene, you know, which still, I found, continues to exist to this day in spite of the really horrific problems of killings of gay men there.
So I'm interested when you talk about Afghanistan, that men are having sex with men there. Are they exclusively having sex with men, or is it just another pleasure-seeking thing?
Well, what surprised me was how much it would actually come up in conversation on a day-to-day basis on the street, where men would talk about, and they would use this English word, homosex, in conversations with you. I would be approached in front of mosques sometimes by men talking about homosex. There's even a legend in Kandahar. Kandahar was the city that the Taliban came out of, and all throughout Afghanistan, there are jokes about the city being the gay capital, ironically, of Afghanistan, and even a legend that when birds fly over Kandahar, they fly with one wing covering their buttocks, if birds had buttocks, so that somebody doesn't accidentally do something to them as they're flying over Kandahar. So that's how strong that reputation is. You know, what happens is in a country where, which is extremely religious, where men are separated from women, sexuality has to find a way somehow. And in some ways, the more conservative, the more strictly that genders are separated, the more you find that men have sex with men. And that sounds very counterintuitive, but considering that it could be deadly to have sex with a woman, men are the next option. Whether many of those men would be gay in the Western sense, you know, is most would not be, but then you find men who, in a different world and with exposure to different things, would probably identify as gay.
You said it would be deadly for men to have sex with women. Can you expand on that a little bit for us?
Well, something that's extremely important to remember in most Middle Eastern countries, most Muslim countries, Afghanistan is not technically the Middle East, but as a Muslim country, you know, the honor and purity of women is extremely important, extremely important. That's why, unfortunately, they have the honor killings that will happen for women who, for instance, lose their virginity before marriage, or even the thought that they might have lost their virginity before marriage. So it can be very deadly for the woman, it can be very deadly for the man. However, because men are around men all the time, you know, one thing can lead to another, and actually the homosexual behavior can actually be hidden in public. And because men are always around men, you know, nobody would question why two men happen to be very close.
Being Caucasian in these countries, I'm sure you stood out a little bit. Did you find you were approached or given more attention or less attention?
Well, you can't tell on the radio what I look like, but I'm Italian-American, so I don't look typically American. In fact, I've had some security problems because there's a perception that Americans are blonde and blue-eyed, and I am not. I am brown-haired and brown-eyed. So I was almost, had actually a very dangerous situation dealing with some Australians, actually, at a UN compound in Afghanistan who thought I was an Afghan breaking into the compound. But I don't look typically American. People, when they look at me, they're not sure where I'm from, but they never assume that I'm American. Sometimes they would think that I'm Afghan-American. Sometimes they would think that I'm Arabic. On my trip to Iraq, most people thought I was Syrian or Lebanese. I've been detained in Turkey for impersonating an American because they assume that America. I'm very serious. They assume Americans are blonde and blue-eyed, and if I have brown hair and brown eyes, I can't possibly be an American. And, you know, you think that our television system appears to be diverse enough, but it's obviously not. And the images that get projected to the rest of the world, and I think people would assume that Australians are blonde and blue-eyed, like Kylie Minogue. That's your typical Australian as well. But when I'm there, I blend in ways that most Americans cannot. If I grow a beard, for instance, in Afghanistan, people in Afghanistan actually thought that I was, and I couldn't believe it when I saw images of him, Fardeen Khan, who was a Bollywood movie star. So people would chase after me thinking that I was this Bollywood movie star. So I never, ever, ever get pegged as an American. And that perhaps allows me to blend in and have these experiences in ways that a blonde, blue-eyed American might not. Certainly it makes things safer for me in many ways, and also allows me to sort of penetrate in a certain way into the culture. At the same time, I don't speak the language, you know, and maybe if I was blonde and blue-eyed, I'd get attention in different ways. People might be touching my hair or something, because people can be very curious about blonde hair. But I find I blend in a way that a typical fair-haired, waspy American would never be able to blend in.
Being able to blend in a little bit more, did you find you were able to learn more about homosexuality in these countries? Were people more open with you?
Well, I think it depends. I mean, one of the things that I had recently done in Iraq was I went to a cafe that was very popular among gay men in Baghdad. And the gentleman who took me around, he first wanted to meet me because he wanted to make sure that if he took me around, that I wouldn't stand out. Because if I stood out, that would get too much attention for him. So anyway, he met with me and he said, oh, you know, you could pass as a local, you could pass as an Iraqi Christian. Iraqi Christians tend to be a little fairer skinned. Or you could pass as a friend, you know, from another Arab country. Again, Syrian or Lebanese is what most people thought that I was. So he said, as long as you don't say a word, you know, because the problem would be I don't really speak Arabic, then he brought me around. So I think in that way, because I looked a little closer to people from the region, I was able to go to this cafe that was very popular with gay men. And had I been blonde and blue-eyed, this contact of mine would never have taken me there. Within Afghanistan, what I was told, which is interesting, is I'm a little bit chubby, and I was told that the way that I look, because I look close enough to an Afghan and I have a round face, when men like to have sex with other men, it is the look that they look for, is what I was told, a slightly round face. So that's not just the fact that I was brown-haired and brown-eyed, but that I had a little bit of baby fat on me. which allowed men, which is one of the things that was a reason, was explained to me why men might have approached me more to talk about homosex than they might have other men.
Did they let you know why they prefer men with rounder face with a little bit of chubbiness on them?
I don't know. I guess if in a war-torn country, that's just, you know, that's a sign of health, perhaps.
Yeah.
It's really hard to explain. I mean, there is actually, what I found very interesting is there's a book, An Unexpected Light, by Jason Elliott. He's British and he's straight. And it's a memoir that he wrote about his time living in Afghanistan during the Taliban era. And he talks about his particular look, and how men would approach him for sex because of his particular look, which might have been similar. And again, he was brown-haired, brown-eyed. He didn't look like a Brit. And might have had a slightly round face and very smooth skin. So he was constantly, in his book, he talks about that, how men had approached him also because of that kind of look. So it's, for whatever reason, it's what is preferred in parts of Afghanistan.
Michael, at the moment, is it safe to visit Afghanistan for anybody, or gay visitors in particular?
Well, I have not actually been to Afghanistan in a few years. It is significantly more dangerous than it was when I was last there. I do want to state, I mean, you know, when you talk about gay visitors, when you talk about gay travel, this isn't the same as going to, what is it, Darlinghurst in Sydney or...
Oxford Street or Brighton in the UK.
Yeah, Oxford Street. It's not the same. You know, I don't want to give... I want to make sure that that's very clear, that this is a very different kind of atmosphere from anything that we have in the West. So, you know, being gay, quote-unquote, might come up in conversation, or the idea of men having sex with men might come up in conversation, but, you know, it's a completely different world from what we know. Kabul, I think, is relatively safe compared to other parts of the country. Kabul is relatively cosmopolitan. You do have a large amount of foreigners living there. Unfortunately, there have been a terrible rash of recent bombings, including within the... including by the U.S. Embassy in central Kabul. So it's nowhere near as safe as it had been when I was there 4 years ago. And in fact, there was a bombing that has occurred. In my book, It Travels in the Muslim World, I talk about a conversation that I had with an Afghan and a party that he'd invited me to. And the very spot where we were standing was where a horrific bombing had happened a few years later. So it's not as safe at all. What surprised me when I went to Baghdad in Iraq was that compared to 2 years ago, it is significantly safer to move around within Baghdad. You still have these horrific bombings, unfortunately, but day-to-day movement, the ability to go shopping, the ability to go to tourist sites, I was completely surprised by the ability to move around, which did not exist 2 years ago.
Traveling around these Muslim countries, would you say that Westerners have something they could learn from these countries?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that I try to make clear in everything that I write is that sexuality is fluid. And I think that if we look at, you know, in the West, we really want to define everything. You know, like, I'm gay, and this person is straight, and this person... And we, you know, we define things so much, like even... leather bottom daddy, you know, all of these labels that we put on ourselves to really peg what we are.
Which category, yep.
And that is not the case in many Muslim countries where things are very undefined, and it's not just sexuality, but, you know, streets don't even have names, but people somehow manage to get to a place, you know. Things are just not defined. You'll have conversations that are about something, but you never actually talk about what you're really talking about, and you talk around a subject. And sexuality can be that way within these countries. So I think that what we can learn is not to be so rigid in our labels and in our definitions of things. And that I find very interesting. And even the notion of hospitality, I think, is very important to learn from within these countries. Even if people hate people, they can be very respectful towards them, which within the United States right now, we're actually having a lot of trouble with respectful discourse, even at the congressional and presidential level. I don't know if that's making the news in Australia, though. So those are some things that we can learn. I think also just One of the things that I talk about is things are not black and white. Things, there is danger, but things are nowhere near as dangerous as the news might have you think. And I also think it's really important to visit places yourself and really see what they're like, rather than, you know, writing off entire parts of the world as something that we shouldn't visit, we shouldn't go to. The other thing is, you know, there's a lot of gay diplomats, a lot of gay business people that go to parts of the Middle East, and their experiences, because of this nebulous nature, are really fascinating and really interesting. And I really think, again, because things are so undefined, that it's very much worth exploring for the gay traveler. Again, it's not going to be like going to Darlinghurst or Oxford Street, or, but it will be fascinating, very fascinating.
It definitely sounds like something we can all learn from. I've noticed as we speak to different gay individuals around in countries such as India and other places around Asia, there seems to be a slow trend towards becoming westernized or becoming Americanized. Do you think the Middle East and Muslim countries are at that risk as well?
Yeah, I think that the entire world is like that. I think that everywhere you go, the model for what it is to be gay does come from the West. It comes... I mean, I would even say that the United States has influenced, as arrogant as you might think that to be, that the United States has influenced gay rights movements in other parts of the West, both in Europe and in Australia, in terms of creating a model for what it is to be gay, both commercially and in terms of human rights. That spreading to parts of the Middle East, parts of South Asia, it is true that that is happening. At the same time, you also have an indigenous way of looking at homosexuality. There is a group, Halem, in Lebanon, which really talks about this conflict between what it is to be an indigenous gay rights group and have to be somewhere in between both the West and the Middle East, and where the model can't necessarily come from the West in order to ask for rights. It can't use the model that we use. Some of the arguments that you have by governments within these countries and some of the horrific killings, unfortunately, are because of this conflict, where the model seems to be coming from the West. The unfortunate problem is that if the model is coming from the West in the Middle East, at the same time that the United States is fighting two wars, homosexuality then and gay rights gets lumped in with the conflicts, unfortunately. And this is the same problem that women's rights groups have as well, that if it's seen as an imposition by the West and is part of the U.S.'s invasion of it as well. So there is this system that is a model. There is a conflict that's created by it. There is an indigenous gay rights movement within these countries. But yet, you know, everything gets blended internationally. South Asia and what happened in India recently is fascinating. You know, the repeal of the laws that were put in by the British. I mean, India is a fascinating example. They used to build temples with sculptures of everyone having sex with each other. And then the British came and changed everything. And so, you know, India is trying to get back the way that it was before the British interfered with everything. So some of the homophobia comes from us as well, and comes from the Victorian domination of the world at one time, 100-something years ago.
It's bizarre when England is one of those countries that now allows gay marriage. It's kind of...
It is kind of ironic, but yet the laws that were passed in the time of Queen Victoria still remain within many of these countries. I mean, what's interesting about the Middle East, what I find fascinating, the countries that Britain dominated, you know, while Britain put laws in place in South Asia, in Pakistan and in India, Bangladesh too, I believe, though the laws weren't necessarily put in by the British, but using British law when they became modern countries. Within the Middle East, where the British were so uptight that they could not talk about sex and they could not talk about gay sex. So there actually are not laws in place in some parts of the Middle East which were part of the British mandate. However, the French, who could talk about sex because they were generally more liberal, actually passed the laws and put in place the laws against homosexuality. So that's something that you have, for instance, in Lebanon, which was a Francophone country, that it is illegal to be gay in Lebanon, and yet it is more liberal in a certain way. So that's another one of these strange contrasts that you have with what remains of colonial law within these countries.
Michael, we've touched on your books a couple of times as we've been chatting. Tell us a little bit more about your books.
Well, the book is Gay Travels in the Muslim World. I'm the editor of the book. It was originally published by Hayworth. Hayworth Press no longer exists as it used to. I used to run the line Out in the World, which was a gay travel literature program. The book is now published by Routledge. It's been translated into Arabic by Arab Diffusion in Lebanon. It is the first gay American book ever to be translated into Arabic. It's a collection of stories. I edit it. There are 17 other men who also contribute. Some of them are actually Muslim men. And we have stories. I write on Afghanistan. I have a gay soldier, a gay American soldier who writes on Iraq. There are several stories on Egypt, some stories on Morocco. There's even a story on suburban Los Angeles, a story on Saudi Arabia. So it's a very varied collection of stories also. And I think what's interesting, and when most people take a look at the collection, it does challenge our stereotypes, both of what it means to be Western and gay and what it means to be Middle Eastern and gay, and also touches on the nebulous nature of everything. The book, because it looks at current issues, we also touch on Abu Ghraib. For those who are not familiar, Abu Ghraib was the prison in Iraq where men were tortured, often stripped down naked, forced to have sex with each other. So I look at that also in the preface of the book as another strange blending of American domination of the Middle East and an American projection of homophobia in the Middle East, and how we felt that Middle Easterners are homophobic, and so the worst thing we could do is force them to have sex with each other. And yet if the Americans and the Brits forced them to do this, it was really Western homophobia playing into the Middle East. So again, I look at all these current rights issues that are going on in the context of homosexuality within the Middle East and Muslim countries. And again, that nebulous nature, that notion that there's something that we can learn, that notion that things are not quite so black and white, is very common in the book. The problem with the Arabic translation, and we still have not resolved this issue, is that they use the word shaz, which is an old Arabic word for gay, but it really means pervert. And you have to remember, in the time of Stonewall, American newspapers referred to gay people as perverts. They didn't use the word gay. And the word that would be better to use is mithli. So this has created this huge controversy because of the book. And we still have not resolved it. But that's something that we're working on. And I hope to actually have it translated into other languages as well. And we're going to do a volume 2 of the book. I just have to get my act together to get that together.
Definitely sounds like an interesting read. We'll have to get hold of that as well, because for those who don't have the opportunity to travel into the Muslim countries or the Middle East, I guess your book would be the next best thing.
Yeah, I mean, it would give you at least a little bit of a window into this world. And I think, you know, Australia might be a little bit different. I know that the Aussies are in Afghanistan. I can't remember if you guys are in Iraq. Are you guys in Iraq as well?
We're coming out.
You're coming out, yeah. So,
for want of a better phrase.
In what way are you coming out?
Oh, in more ways than one.
So, but, you know, you guys are very involved in this world as well. And I think also one thing to remember, Australia is a very diverse country, and you have a lot of immigrants from this part of the world as well. So even if, let's say, you are not going to be going to the Middle East, you're not going to be going to Muslim countries, within Sydney, within Melbourne, within other cities, you have these populations that you can look at, that you can experience. And I think it's really important to break down those barriers and experience those cultures. Within the United States and within Great Britain, there are also these gay Middle Eastern parties. I don't know if you have them in Australia. Again, it's not the perfect window into the world, but it gives you at least a kind of an idea of you know, what it might like to be around communities like this, where homosexuality might be regarded as taboo, but then in a very private setting, people have fun, people dance, you have male belly dancers. I mean, they're very popular in the U.S. and Great Britain. I know Germany also has such parties. I don't know if Australia does. So
there may be a niche there, Michael. Maybe you should set some of them up. I've just wondered, Michael, you're obviously an American-Italian guy. What prompted your interest in going over to the Middle East and actually discovering it and opening it up to people like ourselves?
A lot of things. I had actually been to the Middle East before 9/11. And remember that I'm speaking to you from New York. I'd been to Egypt, I'd been to Turkey, I'd been to Israel, I'd been to Palestine before 9/11. 9/11 changed everything for me. I am a New Yorker. I used to actually work near the Twin Towers. I actually dug through the rubble of the Twin Towers looking for dead bodies. My brother-in-law was a cop, so I was able to go in into the ruins and into the rubble with him. And that, for me, changed a lot. I am a travel writer, but I began to realize that it would be very important to take whatever work that I do and focus it on regions that we know very little about. So it became important to me, post 9/11, to visit the Middle East, to visit Muslim countries, a part of the world that my country knew really very little about, and in fact became involved in two wars with, and to take what I could and bring that back to my country, both from a mainstream perspective, to write about it tourism-wise, but also the more that I researched things, the more I realized how much homosexuality was very blended in with this. You know, there's an idea that Muhammad Atta, who was one of the men who flew the planes into the Twin Towers, was gay. And there were stories that had come out after 9/11 that maybe it was because he was gay and had to prove his masculinity that he was one of the leaders of this group of men who attacked the Twin Towers. And when you start to read things like that and you start to read the homophobia that's a part of these articles as well, I don't know if it's true or not, I began to see that also homosexuality became very blended in with the idea of terrorism in a certain way. And again, these were perspectives that I wanted to look at. So while it might seem cliche-ish to say that 9/11 changed everything for me, it certainly did. And as a New Yorker, I think that I have every right to say that. So that was also a big part of it. So, it changed everything. But my view, which was not perhaps the same as the Bush administration, was that this is an opportunity to learn more about cultures rather than to destroy them.
Definitely. Michael, thank you very much for your time today. It's been very insightful to learn about the differences in the world, and we continue to learn about more each week, and I definitely think there's many things we can learn from the Middle East.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I think it's, travel and everything's educational and a learning experience for both the traveler and the person that they're visiting. And I want to say thanks for having me on the air.
Thank you very much for your time today, Michael.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Ads.
Hi, I'm Bish.
And that was one of our podcasts, but I still like guys.
I still like girls.
Boys are better, though.
I don't know about that. Listen to another podcast and find out.
Okay.
Joy 94.9.
Hump Day Crew Joycast. Sponsored by MyMac.
The best Apple computer, iPod, and Apple accessory store in Australia.
MyMac.com.au. Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.